in tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hi, and welcome to episode number 20 of the InTech We Trust podcast. This is a field recorded podcast, not on Skype. And we are in Milan, Rome, and I have a whole bunch of friends in the room here, and they are Tech Field Day friends. Why don't we go around the table and have some introductions? Who's on my left?
Who's on your left? Who's on first?
You are.
I don't know who's on second. This is Stephen. Hello, Stephen Foskett here, and I am the organizer of the Tech Field Day events, and I am glad to be here in Milan with my friends. So thank you guys for coming and having such a good time with us.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having us, Stephen.
I'm Andrea Mauro, and I'm from Italy. I'm here in Milan with all of these friends, and it could be a really nice session to... But, yeah.
My name is Blake Crony. I'm a wireless and mobility guy, so this is fun to be on another podcast besides my own, and I don't have to do any of the hosting or editing. So this should.
So while we're at it, what is the address, the URL of your podcast?
It's nsashow.com, a no strings attached show that I do with Samuel Clements, who is going to be ignoring us and just silent in the background.
Awesome. Hi, Sam.
Hi, everybody.
Okay.
He's lurking.
And right next to Blake, a friend of the community, who do we have here?
Yeah, I notice I'm a friend of the community, not part of the community. Not really invited. Like, thanks for playing along. So my name is Jay Metz. I am an R&D engineer for the CTO office of where the UCSs are made at Cisco.
Is that where the wild things are?
The wild things and all kinds of crazy things as well, I guess. And I primarily focus on storage, if I didn't actually say that. So that, I'm a storage geek, much like Stephen is.
Storage from within Cisco.
That's right. But I say that lovingly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The geek part, not about the coming in from within Cisco. Okay. I'm not really sure where the loving part comes in about that.
Okay. And we do have a final partner.
My name is Matt Oswell. I am and now ex-data center engineer focusing specifically on networking now with a software development twist.
Is it like being an ex-parrot?
Yeah. Something like that.
You'll be stone dead in a minute.
Oh, Jesus. Is that how it's going to be?
Yeah, like within the first
crossing
5 minutes,
the streams.
We're already
yep.
So degraded.
All right. Hey, I want to start with a non-story in the news this week. IBM is going to lay off 110,000 people. Anyone wants to cover that?
Well, I think it's been covered and quite hoaxed about it, hasn't it?
Yes. So what was actually, what happened?
I think somebody missed a decimal point, right? Yeah. Pretty much.
Well, not only just a decimal point. It could be like only 8,000 people instead of 110.
Right. Well, I guess the somewhere along the line, someone didn't quite do the math right, and evidently IBM's PR department came back and said that they were going to break their policy of not commenting on rumors because this one was just too stupid to let go. And I think that probably pretty much says it all about the accuracy of that report. Nevertheless, it's no joke that people are actually going to lose their jobs, but it's not nearly the catastrophe that people are making it out to be.
Do they even still have 110,000 people that work for them?
Yeah. So the number that came out was 26% that would have been laid off, which means that they have over 400,000 still.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Blake, by the way, now that we have you on here, we hardly ever have networking or Wi-Fi people on. The FCC announced something about the thing with the hotel thing with Wi-Fi. Help me out here.
Man, that's a lot of things I need to fill in the blank for. This could be interesting.
So what's your thing?
Phrasing. Yeah, so let's see here. So, hotels, like everybody else, they want to provide high-quality wireless, which you may not necessarily believe, but they want to provide it at a low-cost solution. And, they're always about how do we monetize our wireless network. So the idea is that, well, we're going to charge and we're going to make it so that nobody else can use any of their own Wi-Fi spots and bring their own networks for conventions or in the rooms and everything. And Marriott got caught with their hands in this cookie jar, and they decided to block access points and MiFis and stuff from working on at a convention center floor, and they got fined $600,000, which is a pretty large amount. And then they kind of was like, you know, this is fully within our rights because this is our infrastructure, it's inside of our buildings, but wireless is unlicensed medium. Anybody can use it, and the issue then comes into play is that, well, if it's unlicensed medium, you know, do I even have any rights to do this inside of my building? So the FTC has finally posted their guidelines as to what they consider as acceptable and unacceptable to help clarify, because Marriott said they're going to fight it, but then Google and a few others came up and said, no, we're going to fight Marriott and say that you can't do this, you can't block and deny other people's networks. And, you know, the whole containment set up from the WIPS providers, it's almost like, does anybody actually even know what they're doing when they deploy this solution? Do they know what the implications are of doing this? So it's kind of an interesting thing to see play out, and there's very vocal opinions on both sides of the fence as to whether I should be able to block within my four walls or not.
Do you have any details on what was actually the standpoint now from FCC?
I mean, basically, they just come back and say that, you know, this is going to violate Section 333 of the Communications Act as amended. And it's kind of one of those things that they don't necessarily flat out and say that, you know, this is acceptable, this is not. But they're kind of playing it off as saying that you can't do anything that forces consumers to purchase wireless networks. So, meaning that if you do bring a MiFi on, you have to allow it within your environment. You can't just blindly block everything.
What's the legal delineation then between that and, like, you know, I know a lot of companies, they do the same kind of thing for rogue access points connected to, like, a switch, for instance. So legally, how would they be able to justify that? Is that because you're not forcing anybody to purchase anything, it's just the policy of the company?
In other words, does this spell doom for rogue access point anti-rogue technology generally?
I don't think it spells doom for it, because generally speaking, those are performed in a different way. So they're typically, what they're doing is they are actually sending some sort of packet across the wire to see if it is received over that access point. There's some logic behind there to ensure that that rogue access point is actually connected to a switch on your network somehow. Okay. There's various different technologies, and, you know, the different vendors do things differently to try to determine that. So that is, you know, that's still acceptable, because you're, you know, most of the time they just down the port even.
Right.
Well, but you are physically entering the network, right?
Yeah.
It's different from setting up a MiFi in your hotel room.
Right, and that's what this is trying to focus on, is the fact that you can't just deny service via RF to a random access point, because that is blocking a wireless signal, which is part of that part of the Communications Act, that you can't do that, period.
So that was actually my next question, because I don't have a clue how I would block wireless. How would block radio? And
yeah,
how does that? Because they need Wi-Fi, right?
Exist. I mean, if this is so illegal,
maybe the hotels work.
So there's two different ways. There's the blocking of the RF signal via a jammer. So I'm just going to send out it doesn't even need to be an accurate signal. It just needs to be a corrupted or just some kind of energy on the RF. And typically those jammers are across the entire 2.4 band or across the entire 5 gigahertz band, whatever you're blocking. They're wideband jammers. And they are just as powerful as they can, and they create it so that the duty cycles fill up so nobody can get any packets through.
Because they're illegal, this kind of jammer?
They're not legal, no. This is something that you purchase from China, and you import it as a sound generator, is what they're typically marketed as. And there's been cases of this with cell phone jammers and stuff. Now, the other way of doing it, which is what is being talked about here in this case, is where you can mimic yourself to act as that SSID, and you can send deauthentication frames to the client, so that says you need to deauth, you know, and so essentially what you're doing is you're telling the client to constantly deauthenticate itself from the network that it's connected
this
to.
This is spoofing, is it like...
So they're spoofing the MiFi?
They try a bunch of different methodologies of figuring it out. You can send a directed deauthentication packet to a specific client that says deauth yourself, and you know, I'm this honey potting. You know, it's the same thing that Wi-Fi pineapples do, where you can make the Wi-Fi pineapple take over. And, you know, you can, if you broadcast the same SSID as somebody else and you send a DDoS flood so that you force all the clients offline, they're going to come onto your spoofed network. So essentially what they're doing here is they are sending the deauthentication packets, but they're never trying to create that network as well so that you connect to them.
Does
they're
it also work with non-published SSIDs?
It can work with anything because a non-published SSID doesn't technically exist. There are certain frames that always have to have the SSID name in them, period. Mm-hmm. So we can always learn the SSID name. And that's the security through obscurity checkbox that nobody should ever check because it does nothing for you other than slow down a script kiddie by maybe 10 seconds.
So what's a pineapple Wi-Fi? That's the first
Wi-Fi time. Pineapple. It's a little...
One of the scariest things in existence is what that is.
In the wrong hands, it is very scary, yes. But it's a little... think of it as like a Raspberry Pi with three wireless cards in it.
And it can be an evil access point.
Yeah, and it can just, it can take over, it can run Karma, and it will listen for the SSIDs that people are trying to connect to, and then you can send a DDoS flood on one of the other radios, and then they will force to connect over to yours, and then you could man-in-the-middle attack them, you could do all sorts of fun stuff with them. And that's what you're saying, is in the wrong hands...
Be really an angel.
It's a powerful tool.
It's one of those use it wisely. You know, this is not something that you just mess around with and turn on in like an airport or somewhere, unless if you're you know trying to see what's going on. A lot of people use them for learning and packet captures and kind of pen testing their own infrastructures and seeing what's going on. But I think the interesting part about this is that we've got a clear statement. Well. somewhat clear statement from the FCC now that says that, you know, this is bad, you can't do this. And since this fine was laid down into Marriott, oh, by the way, we have teams, we've stepped up our enforcement of this policy and we're coming after you, is basically the message that they're trying to say.
At least they made a statement.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks, Blake, for for going into that. While we're here, so we are here courtesy of Cisco in Milan at Cisco Live. We did Tech Field Day a whole day. I don't even remember how many presentations, but they were between 30 minutes and an hour. Tom Hollingsworth is in the back of the room editing all those videos to get them up online.
On his phone, apparently.
He's working hard.
So
no, he really is. He's not. That didn't mean that ironically. He's been busting his butt.
This is true.
Is there anyone that so we follow Cisco as we follow all the companies closely? Is there anyone of the Tech Field Day delegates that found something new and interesting this week here at Cisco Live that were like, "Whoa, I did not expect to see this"? Or
I am not a wireless guy. My background is primarily in wired variety. I like to learn as much as I can, but the Meraki stuff was interesting to me. It was a good. I'd heard about it for a long time. Obviously, it's not a new thing, but just to get that exposure was interesting. It was probably one of the more engaging presentations that we received yesterday, and I would say definitely one of the more technically detailed. So it was good to get that level of detail, get that introduction, seeing as it's an area I don't get into much.
Yeah, what you are hearing in the background is Samuel Clemens, the other NSA, no strings attached. Podcast guy coming closer because we did have a couple of conversations about that Meraki stuff, did we, Sam? And my comment was that I saw a company within a company being Meraki within Cisco. It is a totally separate company. It's like a startup within the big A-brand behemoth. And they kind of act like that. They're the ones in the flashy green t-shirts with sneakers and watches. But they also have an awesome user interface that is nowhere near what we have ever seen from Cisco and other products. But they also have their own hardware. And that was very weird for me, that they have access points, they have switches, they build their own hardware. How does that come and how does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's really the hipster division of Cisco, right? They're in San Francisco and they're all shiny and new and, you know, sort of the new kid on the block, if you will. But, it's really a common thread when we talk about Meraki and product placement and where they fit really in customers' portfolios because people want to distill it down to, well, if I've got two switches, what are the differences between the two switches? And in reality, what the story is when you are a Meraki customer, you're not When you buy a switch from Meraki, you're not buying a switch. When you buy an AP from Meraki, you're not buying an AP. When you buy a firewall, you're not buying a firewall. When you buy all of these things, you're buying the cloud. And the Meraki story has been and always will be, they deliver cloud-based infrastructure. And they really want to remove the conversation about, we're delivering all these services and hardware on premises with... with all of the various and sundry heavy lifting things that typically come with those type of solutions. CLI configs, typically heavier IT admin burden on an organization. You know, if everything rolls up into the cloud and you have an entire portfolio built around one single pane of glass, and I hate to use that term, but there you have it. It's a single interface.
You throw these buzzwords out, man.
I know.
Are we getting the Jack Daniels out? So we can do some shots.
Probably. So it really does revolve around cloud. And when you stop and when you take the conversation and you distill it down to, we're not comparing APs to APs. We're comparing on-premises solutions to on-premises managed solutions to off-premises managed solutions. When you drive it into the cloud, it is all about cloud, and that's really the conversation. But you're right. It's regardless, there is still some challenges. They still are the new kid on the block, and everybody still does see two competing hardware platforms.
There goes my comment. Yeah, if everything is in software and you have this company where you are part of that has been building like top-notch A-brand switches and access points, why the hell would you still need to do that? Does it somewhere make sense for you?
At some point it does, but I don't know that today the cloud-based product offerings are driven around simplicity of a product, which is traditionally not Cisco, right? I mean, let's be frank
Fair
about
point.
It, right? And so, the Meraki team really values the simplicity of their product set, and it's the 80-20 rule, right? They implement the 20% of the features that get most folks 80% of the way, and that's not a dog on anybody. Other than, do you really want a cloud based UI with every blasted widget in it? What's the feature set of a 5K? 30,000 features. Do we have somebody in the room that can answer that? do you really want all of that in one web page that's easy to use? No, not really.
But having been a follower of Meraki for a while and seeing what they were about, and even when they got scooped up by Cisco, and the messaging was that they were going to continue to sell into a specific market segment that wasn't really being touched by Cisco, and now with the announcements of them having a bigger enterprise portfolio, do you feel that perhaps with Cisco's drive to do things with software now, to integrate management into those things, that it is something we've always been asking for a while since the acquisition, is Meraki eventually going to create some kind of cloud dashboard that will manage Cisco devices, or could Cisco possibly take the experience that they have with Meraki and create plugins for like Prime Infrastructure Manager that give you a Meraki-like management experience of Cisco devices?
Yeah, so we're sort of seeing that in reverse, actually, with Prime Infrastructure 2.2, you can actually hook that into the Meraki dashboard, and you can actually bring some of those Meraki assets information into your Prime Infrastructure on-premises NMS platform, right? And so we're seeing that, and we are in, as we talk to product developers and teams who are sort of managing products moving forward, we see them collaborating together on where does it make sense to leverage information resources and things that we already have. How do we start bringing these two things together? The convergence is not going to happen for a really long time.
Okay, thanks. A couple of things in the market as well this week was we have the Q4 earnings call from VMware, where we had numbers of 1,000 vSAN customers. Have you seen? So, Andrea, you are a VMware specialist at multiple levels. Have you seen vSAN in the field yet?
Actually, in some cases, in some user cases, yes, makes sense, like VDI or branch office, some kind of branch office, because you need at least three nodes. It's growing, I think. The main feature is the simplicity that you cannot have in just to click with other product, because in any case you have to build the vSphere infrastructure, and then you can enable vSAN just in few minutes, in few seconds. In other hyperconverged solution, you have to build the infrastructure, could be fast, could, you can have deployment solution that also build the hypervisor part, but I don't see so easy as vSAN.
I mean, a thousand, it's not really much for VMware as such.
But it's version one.
It's version one. That's where I was going to.
Yeah.
Having a thousand deployments is probably going to get you more in-field experience with your Gen 1 product than most startups get before they are at Gen 3 or 4.
Yeah, for sure is not comparable with other solution yet. Next week there will be partner exchange, so probably there will be several announcements.
Well, we're probably going to hear something about Gen 1.5 or 2.
Yeah, so something new, for sure.
Yeah, we expect that.
The maturity of vSAN probably can be reasonable next week, to see how can be ready for all the type of market, for data center deployment, for business critical application, and so on. But is a first step, and as a first step, first version is absolutely interesting. There were a couple of issues with compatibility, with not clear compatibility. Storage compatibility is not the same, could be not the same as vSphere hypervisor compatibility.
Yeah, most issues. Well, that's where you have the vSAN ready nodes, and then later
exactly vSAN,
right?
EvoRail are the best way to be sure that it works. It works with good performance and good reliability, because hardware is absolutely important. Mm. Okay, it's commodity, but must be verified.
Yeah. So vSAN is one of their new products that VMware has. So they have a couple of customers. While I have some networking people in the room, do they have NSX already in the field?
So that's a good question. I actually I don't do a lot of VMware myself. In fact, a lot of what I've focused on in the past year or two has been the open source varieties. I did notice the SAN Central reported, I guess, the result of the earnings call that VMware recently had, which showed a large increase in NSX customers. It says 400 customers, and that's after reporting the third quarter report, which was only 250. And I think it was actually only 100 the quarter before that. So it's showing pretty steady increase in growth, which is interesting. It's hard for me to say, you know, I don't know, you know, why that, if I may speculate, I think it's a pretty easy to get into, especially seeing as it's just software. Cultural differences aside between the networking and the server team, it just kind of shows where people's heads are at, right, with the adoption of this kind of tech.
Yeah. Okay. Great. While I have the networking people with me, let me cover also the there were a couple of, we also cover always merger and acquisitions and finance changes in the market. And I think it was last week that we heard Pluribus getting a $50 million round investment. That's growth capital, right?
Oh yeah.
What do people in the room that have heard of Pluribus have to add to this?
Well, this is Steven. So Pluribus has presented at Networking Field Day. They'll be back actually in a couple weeks at Networking Field Day again. I think that we were actually their first view to the world. I'm really impressed by the team and what they're doing there. And yet, I have a feeling that they didn't need this money to survive, that they brought in this money because they want to step on the gas and hire a lot more people. I mean, they're very much in startup mode at this point, but I would not be surprised if this takes them out of startup mode and into corporate mode.
Yeah, so the $50 million for Pluribus is not the same $50 million that VM Turbo has, because VM Turbo is ready for expansion to Europe. And would Pluribus be ready for expansion, a global expansion to Europe and so on, rather than using that money to... Are they at the same maturity of the product already?
It's hard to say. I mean, the product's older. What do you think, Tom?
I think that with Pluribus, the $50 million is going to go to develop some functionality that, quite frankly, they're going to need to compete in the enterprise. One of the things when we talked to them at Networking Field Day 8 was we're missing some functionality like distributed gateways and things like that. Okay. I know that it's really hot in the white box market right now. Everybody is just killing it with companies that are looking at making a real shift. But a lot of the companies that are doing it in hyperscale and web scale. And that just doesn't really make sense for an enterprise to take a chance on someone unless you have 100% feature parity and there's a clear advantage that you're going to be able to monetize and bring back to your company by taking a risk on something like this. Because, I mean, frankly, right now there are still features in white box switches that you have to reboot to get enabled, and that's not something that an enterprise is going to really tolerate. So with Pluribus, I think they're ready to put the finishing touches on something that will be enterprise ready shortly.
Well, I mean, they've really focused on just a few things. I think, based on the two presentations that I've sat through with them, Network Field Day 7 and then 8, they've focused on a few things and tried to do those things really exceptionally mm-hmm. well. Yeah. I remember the first time they demonstrated all of the flow monitoring capabilities locally. We joked on Twitter a lot about how the CTO was sitting down and getting some magic going, and they do that really well. And they do something unique with the PCI bus. Instead of using the normal bus to get to the ACE to get to the merchant silicon, they do PCI and they have all kinds of optimizations around that. They do all that stuff very well. But like you said, there's a lot of features that a lot of other switches that maybe aren't as focused on those kind of things, that people have sort of come to expect. And if I might speculate, I think this money would be useful to start to, now that they've really mastered what they consider to be their kung fu, now that they can expand and do the sort of the basic stuff.
If you look at the type of customers, where do you put Pluribus use case wise? This is where the product fits. And you could compare that to maybe one or two other companies that play in a similar or attaching differentiation.
Well, I mean, Big Switch is the 800-pound gorilla of that market right now because they've just been doing it for so long. Now, granted, the Big Switch that you see today is not the Big Switch that Guido started so long ago. I think Kyle and his group have done a really great job of moving Big Switch somewhere where they need to be. Customer-wise, I mean, this is a slam dunk for people that are already doing massive-scale DevOps, CI stuff because they've already got the talent in-house to, fix things when they break. I mean, this is not for the faint of heart. I remember a great story from a customer summit a couple years ago. Some guy came out and was talking about all the great things that they were doing with OpenStack and how they had a core team of developers working every night to make it the most awesome thing ever. And the guy right next to him that ran a very similar line of business said, well, we use CloudStack because, it has support. So, this is not a knock on Pluribus or Big Switch or Cumulus or any of the other upstart networking companies, but there's still a lot of customers out there that don't have the kind of tolerance for fixing their own problems. They would rather pay somebody to make it go away.
Okay. You do have to end this conversation with a grain of salt because, especially, I'm coming out of the whole, small to medium business now.
Yeah.
And it's easy to lose your mind once you start to think about these kind of things.
Exactly. You will actually be writing something very focused for the company that you're joining, you're going to actually do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different. It's just totally different. It's, you're running infrastructure on one hand, where you have to rely on functionality that's been provided to you, and then on the other hand, you build that functionality yourself. And there are reasons to not do that, and there's also reasons to do that. So you have to really understand where these products fit, you know, in order to really weigh in.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Hey, Stephen, I have to ask this one to you because it's also a recent one. We heard that something happened with NextGen that have been acquired and shifted around owners and other companies, and they're being spun off out of SanDisk. Can you give a little bit more details on who, what, where, and why?
Sure, and you know, just by way of background, here's the very, very short lesson. A long, long time ago in Colorado, basically we started with Left Hand, which was one of the pioneers in iSCSI. They were a very, very successful company, and they eventually went to HP. So Dell got Equalogic, HP got Left Hand Networks. And the Left Hand team then, after a few years, came back to do it again with a kind of a left-hand 2.0, and that was NextGen. So, you know, NextGen is really, you know, son of Left Hand, a lot of the same, you know, team there, the same founders. And, you know, NextGen came in with the same thing that was going on in the greater industry in terms of building a hybrid flash and disk storage system. So along with companies like Tejal and, of course, Nimble, and others building, you know, flash and disk. That, funny enough, at Tech Field Day, we were all surprised to learn that they were being acquired by Fusion.io. Now, Fusion is famous for their flash memory systems. That was a surprise to a lot of people. They made a reasonably good case for why they might do that, in that basically they felt like a storage array is another necessary interface platform for flash, and that having access to storage array software would be good for their flash business.
The technology is based on Fusion.io, I guess.
Yeah, they also use Fusion.io.
So how does that work?
It's, the technology is not based on Fusion.io.
Any more than it's based on Seagate or Western Digital.
Yes.
Or,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. It's not because they're using the...
I was just curious how that worked. If they bought the company that where the drives were based on Fusion.io.
No, yeah. A lot of companies used Fusion.io.
Sure.
Yeah, they were close. And they, you know, one of the unique aspects of the NextGen solution is that they don't treat flash like a disk. They've treated it like, you know, memory addressable storage. And that's a big difference, and that's a big Fusion.io differentiator. So... now they use SanDisk. So Fusion.io got bought by SanDisk. SanDisk apparently didn't see a future for a
any solution that array. Uses a disk. That was kind of the message that came through the news, the press release, or the articles. Were like, well, you can put a disk in it, so that's not our core business. So let's get rid of it. What do you see? What happened there? And so the comment we made on the show last week or 2 weeks ago when that happened was, well, there are so many hybrid players today. Isn't that market, first of all, saturated with products? Look at a Nimble. What are they doing? Look at Gentry, how good they're doing. So those come... It is quite of a... All the A-brand players do have their products in a hybrid solution. You've got... pretty really good players already there in the hybrid space. We haven't heard of that much of NextGen. Maybe through the acquisitions, it's not their own fault, but will they be able to raise enough money to be an independent company, and can they actually be a good competitor with a Nimble, with a Tejal, with a Tintri out there?
Yeah, and that's the, you know, however million-dollar question. They're not saying how many million it was, but yeah, I mean, they got private equity and they spun out of SanDisk and they're an independent company again. The question is, you know, what now? Yeah. On the plus side, they're not a new company. They don't have a new, you know, it's not a new product. It's a product that is now in, you know, it's been shipping for a long time. It's got a bunch of customers. You know, this is not a startup with some new ideas. This is a, you know, proven product with a proven team behind it. And pretty much the whole team stayed. The question, like you say, is there room in the market for all these products? The answer is probably no. But on the other hand, think about it this way. 10 years ago, storage was made up by pretty much the same big players, but there was a thriving and healthy mid-range ecosystem of companies that were challengers, and they were all doing really well. You know, I mean, certainly Equalogic was, I guess you could call them the Nimble of their time, right? I mean, they're really doing well.
Well, I called the Nimble the Equalogic of their time, so.
Exactly. And, yeah, and 3PAR and Blue Arc and companies like that, there was room in the market for them. And so, yeah, there could be room in the market for these guys. Absolutely. Another thing I think that I'd like to point out, one of my personal beliefs is that there's no such thing as a hybrid array market. There's no such thing as an all-flash array market. Or the challenge is, what does the thing do? Nimble is a full-featured storage array. You know, next-gen. Full-featured storage array. Pure Storage is a full-featured storage array. I feel like these products compete head-to-head-to-head with, you know, EMC's, VNX, and HDS, and Dell, and HP. They all have full-featured storage arrays targeted right at the middle of the market. That's a really big market. If you were to invent a make-believe category like all-flash arrays, then there really isn't enough room for even one company to play in that market. But if you say these are not all flash arrays, they just happen to use all flash, but they're targeted at the entire storage market, suddenly there's a lot of
headroom. That's the Pure Storage of today, right? They are the all flash player that actually competes with all the existing hybrid disk. They're not an all flash player. They're just the replacement of the generic storage.
And I think Pure likes, from a PR perspective, like saying we're the king of all flash arrays.
Yes.
But they're not an all flash array. Really, from a marketing perspective. Mm-hmm. From a marketing perspective, they're a mainstream array. And that's actually really good news for Pure Storage and for NextGen, because that is a huge market.
While we're having Pure Storage, a really well-funded company, and we're adding the all-flash players into that hybrid market, of which we said is maybe already saturated in amount of players, Caminario, who raised $53 million in December, which is like a month ago, just added a $50 million round with the same investors. What happens there? This is really weird to me. Funding a new funding round. They raised $53 million in December. This is like money to get you going for 2 years, at least. And they're adding another round of $50 million with $15 million with the same investors.
I'm no investment analyst, but when stuff like that happens, there's usually financial things that we don't know about going on in the background. And I'm not going to take a guess at what they're doing. And I certainly don't think that it's not above board or anything. I mean, there's no shenanigans here. It was a banking move, basically. I can't imagine that they went back for 15 more.
Yeah.
There was some process here, some financing process that, frankly, I don't think is all that relevant. But it does sound weird, doesn't it?
They wanted 65 and it came in two rounds.
Something like that.
Yeah, that would have been good. But that brings us another well-funded player in that all-flash market with a couple of other well-funded and well-playing players. Jay, you play in the same industry of storage. Cisco has their own play there. They're adding, and we're probably going to hear more of that. I see a future for Cisco with their solution, the Invictus part. What do you think about it? And not necessarily speaking as a Cisco guy, of course. What do you think about these amount of players, especially a lot of new players, well-funded new players in the hybrid and all-flash market?
Well, not speaking on behalf of Cisco. I mean, but for myself, if you look at the history of the technical market, you constantly have this expansion and contraction, this accordion-like behavior.
Agreed.
You know, and I think what's happening is that we are still on the expansion part. We really haven't quite hit that that elasticity quite yet, and the reason for that is simply because of the fact that the thirst for storage is becoming insatiable. So in the order of a rising tide lifting all boats, I think that if there were mismanaged companies or if there are companies that are not with the most superior product or the most superior marketing plan, they're still in business somewhat because of the fact that there are enough customers out there to buy their kit and keep them alive. for now. What I think is probably going to wind up happening, however, and I completely agree with Stephen's take on what this market really is doing, it's that the idea of an all-flash array as an all-flash array being this main selling point is pointless. Realistically, you see some, you know, you see the Twitter wars of, you know, which is more important, a hybrid array or an all-flash array. And quite frankly, if it gives you back the bit you need, it's a good array.
And if it supports the other things you need, if it does the right. other stuff.
If it does the other stuff. But what's happening now is that you see a lot of people saying, well, I was just reading an article earlier today about how some analyst was saying that, you know, everybody's moving to software-defined storage, which is the most insane thing I think I've read in a long time when it comes to storage, because the reality of the situation is that most software-defined storage solutions that I've seen are actually software-implemented storage, mm-hmm. not necessarily defined.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, that kind of storage market does not necessarily cover all storage that needs to be covered. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of data out there that needs to be treated in a specific type of way, which is why we still have mainframes, why we still have Fibre Channel, why we still have iSCSI. You know, the fact that object storage and Ceph and Swift and these types of things are getting more and more play does not necessarily mean that those others are not valid. So I think that what's happening is that we have a really big market for really big data. And I say that in multiple ways. And I don't think as far as Communitario and NextGen and these other companies, the inherent flaws haven't toasted them yet, because there's just so much stuff to be able to be bought for whatever purpose they need. And to me, it just seems like you're going to have one of a few things. One, either the company is going to come extremely niche. A company will become extremely niche. Two, there will be mismanagement because not all companies can have good management, and those companies will fold or get bought out. The exit strategies of certain companies will come to pass, and they'll be bought out or they'll go to IPO, right? So that's when the consolidation will start in. And, you know, I don't know what the motivation was behind this new investment, but perhaps it could have just been that they're doubling down because they believe in it. You know, mm-hmm. It could be something that simple. Sometimes Occam's razor is a great way of looking at things. But from what I think that's going to happen with the future of this is that you're going to wind up seeing systems of storage as opposed to storage entities. So the hyperconvergence side of things, which we were talking about a little while earlier, is specifically there because most companies don't have entire systems of storage. They don't own everything from the application straight through to the bit on the disk and all those points in between. So hyperconvergence becomes a very good play for them, and when they can start doing some cheap additions into hardware, like the commodity stuff, the OpenStack stuff, the Evo Rails, and those kinds of things, and you know, we were talking about the virtual SAN and so on, because of the fact that gives them a system of storage from end to end. So does that necessarily mean that functionality can't be done in other ways? No. It just means that for those particular...
But maybe you don't need. As right. you said, there is place for everything, different right. case yeah. study.
And I would put Caminario in a very different market from pure...
Right, right, exactly. I mean, you certainly don't see them compared head-to-head in almost any kind of analysis, mm-hmm. you know? So it's really going to take a huge – it's going to take a little bit more work than I think that a lot of analysts and a lot of pundits are going to – will be willing to put in to say, look, realistically, storage is not this monolithic thing where all things are equal and we're moving from one to the other and something's going to die and something's killed and so on.
It's like cars.
Exactly.
Or networking.
Or networking. Everything, yeah.
Or servers or whatever. So, I mean, that was a very long-winded answer, but I think that's probably what I'm going to stick with.
Yeah.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
No. Great. We have a final thing happening, and it's weird. I just read it on the train back from, by the way, today. What was that? We had so for your notice... We had a trip to Lake Como today with the whole team, and we had a blast taking pictures
all day long. It was awesome.
If you have the chance, I highly recommend a visit to Lake Como and Bellagio.
Yeah, or at least watch our pictures in a couple of weeks. So, hey, final story, and I read it in the train coming back to Milan. Symantec is going to do something weird. So Symantec has two major portfolio sets. One of them is info security, and the other is info management, data protection. They're going to spin off the whole data protection back into
Veritas.
Yeah. How about that?
Yeah. I'm no expert on this, but my understanding is that we're going to get our old Veritas back. And unfortunately, it's been so long now that we're not going to get some of our old Veritas people back. Mm-hmm. Because let me tell you, that was a nerdy company, and I mean that in a good way. I was a huge fan of the Veritas, not so much on the backup side, but on the storage side, Veritas Volume Manager, all that stuff. A lot of those people have left by now and have gone on to do all sorts of other great stuff.
One of those guys who built that stuff.
Absolutely. Great stuff. Great technology.
Scary smart people.
And I'm really hopeful that splitting that off of from the consumer stuff will be a good move.
Well, or just splitting it off from Symantec.
At the very least, I can get out my old mugs and shirts and stuff.
Were you afraid to show them out?
No.
Well, in all fairness, the data protection, both of Veritas and Backup Exec have not been doing quite well in the last couple of years. Do they have a chance to restate that quality of the old Veritas?
Could be really difficult because actually, if they split the company in a data protection company, this company will still have Backup Exec and Net Backup in the same. So was better probably have a consumer or small business section and an enterprise sector of the company. In this way, Net Backup has grown, but not so fast. Is still an old product. There are other products that are more complete compared to Net Backup. Actually, is still a good enterprise level product, but is growing really slowly. And Backup Exec has changed so much time to big change in the last two version that
and slow adoption.
Yeah, exactly. And now it's really difficult. The only way could be drop one of these and make a unique product and reinvest on simplicity for the small business and for feature for the enterprise. But
so would it be fair to say that the spin-off is an opportunity, but they'll have to execute on it?
Well, it seems to me that there hasn't been any major paradigm shift in the data protection space since they got, you know, wrapped up before. So the plus side is possibly that, you know, they haven't lost too much traction in the interim, that it's not impossible to, you know, to start taking the lead again. However, it will entirely depend on who we're talking about. You know, if there's a bunch of people who are there to hold the lights on, that's a different story than somebody who's actually got a plan about what they need to do. And realistically, the file space and the data protection space is not able to do everything that needs to be done for all the different types of storage requirements that are coming out. So there's an opportunity for them to do that, to answer your question. They can have – there's a space for them to play if they know how to address it. But it's going to depend entirely upon the brain – I don't know, what's the opposite of a brain drain or the brain reclaim?
Yeah, and they have to make some choice, and difficult choice in mm-hmm. some case because something must change or they have to find the right way where move – the product.
Yeah, and on the negative side of the equation, analysts and so on, people who know a lot more about the business side of things than I do, have speculated that this is more about selling the company than it is about building the company. I hope they're wrong. But if that's true, then that's kind of a sad end for a couple of great names.
Okay. I think we kind of can wrap this one up. We had quite an amount of content in our show this week, and we've never had more than four or five guests, so this was quite a room full of guests. Everyone, thank you very much for joining in, especially also the networking guys who we hardly ever have on the show, which is, well, in all honesty, coming into back to the hotel thinking about what are we going to record on a podcast, I was like, I have no idea what I need to ask these Wi-Fi guys. So I'm really happy you guys are here. Your show is definitely on my subscription list now.
What's it called again?
The No Strings Attached Show. NSA Show.
NSA Show. No Strings Attached. Well played, sir.
Make sure you do No Strings Attached Show.
Yeah.
No Strings Attached is something entirely different.
Yes, we know.
Well, so, I didn't, so actually I'm glad you did clarify.
Clarification.
There you go.
So thanks everyone for joining. And for our listeners, we have another episode of our secret Windows phone app.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love you.
Predator repellent. Sometimes you worry about bears or mountain lions or things like that that might eat you or attack you. Especially sharks that come up from the water and form naturally occurring sharknadoes. So it's a really good thing if you have a Windows phone because they have a predator repellent app. That's right. Think about it. How many people do you know that have Windows phones that got attacked by, like, a grizzly bear when they were walking around with their Windows phones, maybe talking to their mothers or texting their mistresses? But I don't want to go down a rat hole about kind of bad behavior, because you can go on the web and look it up. The facts are facts, and they're out there on the internet. You can use Bing, and you can look up on Bing Dangerous Wildlife Reports Redmond. You'll find out that there are several incidents with cougars in Redmond, Washington, but none of them are particularly dangerous. There was one case where a goat was attacked. That was in September of 2011, but that was a goat, and goats don't use Windows phones. Or if you use Internet Explorer, you can go on this site, localcougarbars.com, and you'll see that there aren't any cougar bars listed for Redmond, Washington. Kind of makes you go, But if you're in another town in that area, maybe like Seattle, where there's a lot of Amazon people, and Amazon people work, and there's a lot more cougar bars, you might need a wild animal repellent, like the Windows phone, to get people to stay away from you at the cougar bar. All you have to do is put your Windows phone up on the bar so everybody can see it, and it's a pretty good bet that most of the cougars there are going to ignore you and find other prey to attack. And if that doesn't have mothers buying Windows phones for their college-age sons, I don't know what will. Tune in again to hear another episode of Secret Windows Phone Apps.